Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Lords Podcast with Will Rowe.
Well, welcome along to the latest edition of the Lords Podcast. Now that the dust has settled, we look back at what legacy Sachin Tendulkar will leave for the game of cricket and pose a tricky question about the little master here at Lords. In the history section of the podcast, we catch up with former England fast bowler Bob Willis. Ahead of the bicentenary of Lords Ground next year, we meet a Middlesex member with a special connection to this place, and there's the small matter of the Ashes series down under. Well, we're in the tavern stand today, which is a little change from our normal position up in the JP Morgan Media Centre. So we're looking out at Lords, square of the wicket, on this nice cold winter's day. And it's my great pleasure to welcome my co-host this month. He played 46 tests for England, taking 177 wickets along the way. Has had a career as a cricket journalist since his retirement in 2002. And he's the current managing director of cricket at Middlesex County Cricket Club and also on the MCC committee. He's very much part of the fabric here at Lords. Gus Fraser, welcome.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing?
I'm not so bad. I've got a bit of a stinking cold, but other than that, I'm all right. And a bit heavy-eyed after watching more of the Ashes than I anticipated last night. I watched the first five overs, then it's the 10 overs, then it's the first hour, and then you're lying in bed and you keep checking on your phone what the score is type of thing. So it grabs you, doesn't it? You sort of have the best intentions, and before you know it, the alarm's off at 6:45. And
there's a lot being made, even in this Ashes series, even though it is a couple ago now, of the first ball, and everyone talks about Steve Harmison bowling it to Flintoff at second slip. Can you remember the first ball? Was it always such a pressured environment?
I think it became that. I'm trying to think now of the first ball, because my first Ashes in 1991, we got bowled out for about 190. So I can't remember. We were batting, so I don't remember the first ball. We got bowled out 190, then bowled them out for 150, and then sort of in a reasonable position and just capitulated on the third morning, and Australia sort of knocked them off quite comfortably. It was sort of quite a famous test match because Alan Lamb, who was the England standing captain, Graham Gooch, had injured himself in the build-up to the test, and he'd been invited out by Kerry Packer to a casino on the night of the second night of the game. And I think Kerry Packer used to give his guests sort of like a $10,000 chip. And you could go in the casino and if you had a good evening, you'd certainly earn more in one night than you would do for a complete tour with England. So Lammy was not out overnight, went there and was seen sort of getting back in the hotel about 1:30 in the morning, and only added four runs to his overnight score, and we ended up losing by 10 wickets. So it wasn't a great memory. And I also remember I didn't get picked initially for the 94-95 Ashes. I was left out. And I was summoned. I went and played great cricket in Sydney, and I got sort of in the middle of the week, or 3 to 4 days before the 3 days before the test. Could you get up to Brisbane quick? Yeah. There's been a couple of injuries. There's an illness.
Chickenpox.
Yeah,
in the
Devon Malcolm had chickenpox. Yeah. And I just remember then sitting down and watching the first over, and Michael Slater cut Philip de Freitas for four twice, and almost that was a bit of a major moment. In the way of here we go again type of thing. And then obviously there's a Harmison to second slip, but equally Strauss was out, I think, in the first over of the 2010-11 Ashes, but it didn't hold England back then. So yeah, it's a bit, well, it is, I suppose, it's like all these things, you work towards that point, and you want to get it right. And if you don't get it right, I wouldn't say it sets the tone for the rest of the series, but it certainly highlights a nervousness if you don't get it right.
Yeah, and upon retiring from the game, you then covered it as a journalist for The Independent from around 2002 to about 2009. How was that shift from being on the field to then suddenly writing about the guys?
I suppose that there's always a feeling that you're going to be compromised, isn't there? And the fact that you're going to be too sympathetic towards the players and not really write it, nail them if they've been having a bad time. But I've always felt that I've been pretty objective about things, and I'm not just going to nail people because that's the easy line. I'll criticise people if they've got things wrong and they've messed up. But if they haven't, you'll try and understand the situation, because it's not always as straightforward. I know newspapers like it to be black and white, but there's often most of your life's in the grey zone, isn't it? And that's sort of whether it's darker grey or lighter grey type of thing. And I know that maybe doesn't sell newspapers, light grey and dark grey. It's black and white that sells newspapers. But I don't know, I didn't worry about that. And you upset some players over the course of your career because you say things. And maybe at times when you're working to deadlines, it's funny, when you've got a deadline, you say, right, something's happened, or the game changes very quickly, and you've sort of been sat down for 4 or 5 hours sort of contemplating how you're going to write this piece, where it's going to happen, then all of a sudden it sort of flips about in the last minute, and you've only got half an hour to suddenly change 600 words and get them to the office. Sometimes they're the best pieces you write, because you just bang, you go for it, and you write without being too thoughtful, it's what you think, what you've seen, get it down. But every now and then you might get the odd little situation wrong. And a couple of times I did apologise to players, because I said, yeah, you're probably right, I did get that wrong. Sorry, wasn't meant, I mean, I'm not got it in for you or anything, but maybe sort of I didn't sort of get everything in a row. And other times you think, well, no, actually, I'm quite happy with that. The fact that I did come down a bit stronger on that occasion, but... No, I didn't have a problem criticising players. I mean, they've got to learn to... I mean, people have views, and it's, again, as long as you can argue those views and support you, the stance you've taken, then I'm very comfortable with that. Always very comfortable, and still am, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And since then, you've moved into a role as Middlesex Managing Director of Cricket. How is it sort of then coming back to Middlesex?
Yeah, I don't know where a poacher, gamekeeper turned. I don't know where I am at this point in time. I keep leaping from one side of the fence to the other as such. Whilst I suppose your playing career comes to an end, and what are you going to do? And if you're an England captain, you might get a job with Sky, or you've played 100 Test matches, your sort of things open. And the less you've played, I suppose, I said a bit, but the further down the food chain you go, as far as as being a sort of a prime candidate for the plum jobs. And the independent. The fact that the Independent came along, and that was sort of backed up with quite a bit of Test match special work, it was more than I could have hoped for, really. I mean, so when that came along, it was a simple decision to retire, because it was such a great opportunity and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And then 7 years down the line, my son had an illness, which sort of, again, he's very healthy now and everything's okay, but he had a sort of tumour on his brain, and that was just before the 2006-07, actually, so I missed the first test there because it happened in October.
Right.
And you suddenly start to think about things and the time you spend away from home, and I'd sort of, if you're sort of a selfish so-and-so, and or you're single and you haven't got sort of any responsibilities back in the UK, then being a journalist is a great occupation, because you're just travelling around the world at someone else's expense, following a great game, getting well looked after. But you're suddenly spending like 25, 30 weeks of the year in a hotel room, and it sounds very sort of exotic and glamorous, and I'm not knocking it, but it does wear a little bit thin after a while, and you do think, well, actually, I would like to spend some more time at home with my family. Your kids suddenly become teenagers, and you can't buy those years back when they're 22 and you've done what you've done. You say, oh, well, come on, Alex, come on, Bethan, now I'm your best mate, and that's going to happen. Well, no, you weren't, you've missed that. So I wanted to be around at that, and that coincided with the Middlesex job. creating this position, the managing director of cricket, and they advertised for it and I applied for it. Fortunately, I've got it. So I've been extremely fortunate, the fact that I've spent 30 years of my working life to date involved in cricket, and it's a pretty good industry to be involved with. There's not many nasty people around in the game. There's a lot of good people, and there's a lot of fun and satisfaction to be gained from working in it.
And I'd like to ask you a few questions on that now. It leads nicely into our Twitter questions, which is a new feature on the podcast that we did last month with Mike Gatting, and you're now next in the firing line. So
right, pulling Gat again.
Here we go. This one's from James Rowland. Who is the best batsman you ever had to bowl to?
Well, I look back at the era that I played, and all right, the English side that I played for didn't have anywhere near the same sort of success as the current side, but I look back, I don't envy the current players or anything like that. I mean, it'd be nice to have earned a bit more money, but the lifestyles we had and the way that we played the game, I think, was better than them in many ways, because we had greater freedom, there wasn't under such spotlight and scrutiny. And also, I played against some great players. I mean, it was, I say, Tendulkar's retirement is almost, the end of an era, really, isn't it? Sort of my era, to be honest. He's the last of the great players that sort of came through when I was, or I played against. And there are other, obviously, your Warnes, your McGraths, your Waughs, your Healy's, your Inzamans, your Wackars, your Wazims, all the West Indians, Viv Richards, Richie Richardson, Ambrose Walsh, etc., etc. So some one Martin Crowe, some really top cricketers that were around, and you feel chuffed a bit that you've actually played against them and been able to pit your wits against some really great cricketers. But of the people that I bowled at, I always put Lara at the top by a little distance. I played against Tendulkar on his first England tour in 1990-91. It was only looking on YouTube actually that I realised, this was a few years ago when I was asked to write an article, that I was the one who scored the 100th run off, his first 100. So yeah. I didn't realise that until I suddenly sort of watched it on YouTube and saw him sort of push me through extra cover for 3 runs to bring up his first international 100. So I'd sort of played my role in getting him on his way. But that was the only time I played Test cricket against Tendulkar in 1991, and he was only about 17 at the time, so he was making his way. Obviously watched him a huge amount as a journalist and as a cricket fan, and just loved watching him. I mean, wonderful player, an all-time great, but Lara was the biggest cricketer that I had the pleasure of playing against. He got 100 here at Lords against Middlesex for Warwickshire 1 year. Hit John Embry, actually. It would have gone over the pavilion, I think. The ball got wrapped in the flag at the top of the flagpole above the Middlesex dressing room.
So Albert Trott's record still stands.
Yeah, it does. Pollard had a good go at it, didn't he, the other year? And sort of hit the lift shaft at the back. But, like I say, playing against Lara, he's got 375. He got other hundreds along the way. And I think he was someone, if he was batting, and you'd sit down and watch it, you wouldn't sort of leave the room. Because you never knew what was going to happen. A glorious, destructive player. If it was his day and he was in the mood, it very, very difficult to bowl at. And you look at the history of the game, and he's probably played half a dozen of the best, six of the best 15 innings that have ever been played.
And is it true that there's a Gus Fraser wing in one of Brian Lara's house? Yeah. In the Caribbean.
Quite a few of my contemporaries are getting sort of stands named after them around. I mean, you go to Somerset, there's a Andy Caddick Pavilion, you go to Worcester, there's a Graham Hick Pavilion, there's Alex Stewart Gates at the Oval. You've got to do a bit more than I did to get something named after you at Lords. Compton, Edrich, Warner, Allen. But yeah, Lara sort of built a beautiful house with the proceeds that he made from scoring 375 in Trinidad, and he named areas of that house after the bowlers that had bowled at him and allowed him to amass the fortune. So I've got an area of Brian Lara's house named after me. Nothing at any cricket ground, but a little bit somewhere in Trinidad.
Absolutely. Next question from Twitter. This is from Tom Cox. What was your biggest highlight of your career, and what was your biggest regret? Highs and lows, really.
I thought the biggest regret was never winning the Ashes. Thankfully, achieved a lot. I had won one-day tournaments at Lords with Middlesex, won championships with Middlesex, won one-day competitions with Middlesex. So, all right, the last maybe 5 or 6 years of my career were at Middlesex. We sort of tapered off and fell away as a club. But all in all, for 12 or 13 years, we were one of the top sides in the country, and we won things quite regularly. So that was very satisfying. And I say, personally, obviously very proud of what you achieved as an England player. It'd be nice to have done a little bit more, but for an injury and some selection issues, I may well have played another 20 tests and got another 75 wickets, and probably that would have been, I'd have said, yeah, that's about where I'm at. So, yeah, I say not winning the Ashes, again, but playing against the great Australian side was a thrill. But not having won that, and obviously seeing the way that players that have won the Ashes are viewed, would have been nice. And highlights, I think, there were individual games. Winning in Barbados, which was in 93-94 winter. I got 8 for in Barbados. Alex Stewart got 100 in each innings. I think it was the first time England had won in Barbados for over 50 years, and it was one of those. Again, I love touring the West Indies because they're small, intimate sort of grounds with a really unbelievable atmosphere, sort of excitable. And it was a sort of start of the England sort of Barmy, not the Barmy Army. Well, it might be the Barmy Army, but England's major support when they were abroad, and I think sort of 15,000 people inside Kensington Oval, and half, 7,000 or 8,000 of them would have been English, and sort of a full house on the fifth day when we won that game, and that was special. And beating South Africa as well, we beat South Africa in a 5-Test series 2-1, and I managed to get a few wickets in that series. So yeah, lots of highlights. I mean, along the way, I mean, even though I say the ultimate would have been winning the Ashes, which sadly we failed to do.
Lovely. Our next question from Menno Faulkner. Jimmy is often seen as the world's best bowler, but how do you rate him and Broad in Australia? I guess he's hinting at the height and pace and balance of Broad down under.
It's an interesting one because Anderson, I mean, he did a programme with Sky, a bowling masterclass, and it's as good as I've seen. The skill, the precision that he added to his bowling, and you were watching something there that was in a different sort of league to anything I sort of felt that I could do. And I thought I had pretty good control. So Anderson is an exceptionally skilled bowler. I suppose the thing you, at the end of the day, it's your career, and his career average is 30, which is modest. I mean, it's still reasonably good, but it's not sort of Dale Steyn, who's averaging 21, 22. So, I mean, England have got some fine bowlers in Anderson and Broad, but are they going to be all time? I mean, Anderson will be because of the volume of wickets that he's taken. He's probably going to be England's highest ever wicket taker. He'll go past both, I'm sure, in the next year or two. But is he as good as your Ambroses, your Marshalls, your Dale Steyns, your Richard Hadleys, your Dennis Lillies, people like that, Wasim Akram and Wacker? Possibly not. And you sort of say that, and all of a sudden you sort of, I'm aligning myself up for a kicking from someone here who's saying, well, you're a bitter and twisted old so-and-so. But you've got to look at these players' records. And sort of, Jimmy Anderson is a magnificent bowler, an outstanding bowler, and he's got better, and he's been better for the last 4 or 5 years. But over his career, comparing his career to other players have performed more consistently throughout their careers. So he'll be remembered as well. Obviously one of England's finest bowlers, but is he as good as Richard Hadley? Is he as good as Dale Steyn? Is he as good as Malcolm Marshall? No. Sorry to be blunt, but no. Stuart Broad is a wonderful bowler too, and I think, again, he took 5 wickets on the first opening day of the Ashes, which is a cracking achievement. He seems to rise to the challenge and just have magnificent days where he's almost unstoppable. And again, his maybe bounce and his ability to manoeuvre the ball means that he's probably got a little bit more threat than Anderson, who's very skillful swing seam and skiddy, but the extra bounce that Broad's got probably means that he's likely to be a bit more effective over the course of his career.
Well, talking about greats of the game just a moment ago, as we mentioned at the top of the podcast, Sachin Tendulkar has retired from Test cricket, and as you were saying a few moments ago, it's certainly an end of an era.
Tendulkar goes to 100. He does it with one of the hardest shots in the game, executed perfectly. That is a marvellous performance.
And we were playing just a warm-up game, and we'd heard about this young star who'd just made 300 in a school game. And he came out in those spongy pads that he used to wear, and he just smashed us for about 30 or 40. And we were the England side there, and I thought, crikey, as a young schoolboy, this lad can bat.
In recent times, he and Brian Lara have taken the batting honours for outstanding batsmanship at the very highest level.
I think the legacy he's left is that he embarked on, at age 16, on what has now become the greatest cricketing career of all time. I mean, that is one thing I feel I can say with no argument from anybody else.
You know, his rise is absolutely linked in with the rise of India as an economic superpower, as a cricketing superpower. His career has spanned that rise completely. So I think, put him in context, you know, it's a bit bigger than just a great player who scored runs of his own accord. It's a bit bigger than that.
He was the first cricketing superstar. I mean, I think there's so many, a lot of the Indian players have sort of followed in his footsteps recently, but, you know, he was the first guy that had to deal with that incredible attention at all times, as well as, you know, the pressure of having to perform in different forms of the game. So his legacy is to be able to do all of that, but do it in a kind of humble, gentlemanly fashion, which is what he was so good at.
Tendulkar reminded us that his strokes could be as pure as ever.
Few familiar voices there for cricket fans discussing Sachin Tendulkar. There's quite a lot in that, Gus, but I mean, I guess the overriding thing is that he was truly one of the greatest batsmen that's ever played.
And he'll be looked on as that in 1500 years' time, and quite rightly so. Whether anybody goes past him is questionable. The volume of international runs he scored, the number of international hundreds he scored, you do wonder whether, in the same way that is Don Bradman ever going to be gone past, whether this fellow's going to be gone past.
But he never quite managed to get on the honours boards here at Lords. I'd like to segue into a little chat about the Lords honours board, and certainly not picking on Sachin Tendulkar, because as we'll see in a moment's time, there's some very, very good names that also didn't manage to do that as well. But for all the tourists that come to this ground and go on the famous Lords tour, often the stewards that take them up into that, the away dressing room, there's certain notable names which aren't on there. Brian Lara, Sachin Tendulkar and Shane Warne are just three to mention.
Monarithram, Ponting.
There you go, two more. I've tried to make this a little bit easier for us, Gus. I've picked Wisden's all-time 11, which they released this year. And, well, if we just start there, and then we can try and come to, in the next few minutes, who we think's the greatest never to get on the board. So just looking at that, WG Grace never made it on the honours board, but slightly different era. Sachin Tendulkar didn't do it. Wazim Akram, he took four wicket. His best was 4 for 66 in 1992. Waqar Yunus took 5 for in that game, and Shane Warne as well. I mean, just looking through some
That's
of
an
his
interesting
names.
One, Wazim, because I hadn't sort of put him in that, but quite rightly he should be there because he is one of the all-time greats as well as a left-arm seam bowler. Is it chance? I suppose it is chance to begin with. I mean, I was fortunate enough to be up there a couple of times, and all right, playing at home, you've got a better chance, especially now because you're playing two tests a year as an England player. When I sort of started, there was still some years there were two, some years there were one. But they weren't, the honours boards weren't up at the start of my career. Then all of a sudden, I can't remember what years they suddenly appeared on the wall in the dressing rooms. And again, there's a bit of disagreement about where the honours board should be. I mean, there are a lot of MCC members who think that the honours board should actually be up somewhere in the pavilion so that the public can see, or the members can see. But I think that they're right where they are. It's a private thing. It's a players' thing. They should be up in the dressing room because that's where, and they are extremely inspirational. And I suppose every player does come here hoping that they will get on those boards, and that as a tourist, every 4 years, so you might be lucky and you might get three chances in 8 years. You might only get one chance in 7 years, depending on when your career sort of how your career sort of unfolds. But the longer it goes, the bigger the pressure, and you could see it. Someone like Tendulkar, someone like Lara, someone like Ponting, they didn't look the same here as at other grounds, because I think that that weight of expectation, that desire to be on there, and for people in 50 years' time to be being shown around Lords long after we've all gone, and the fact that your name is up there is something that you're exceptionally proud of. I don't think Tendulkar would foregone the fact that he'd say, well, I'd be happy with 95 hundreds and as long as one was at Lords, because getting to 100 hundreds is remarkable. But I'm sure if you went to people like Ponting and Lara, Gilchrist, say Jack Callis, these sort of figures, they would quite happily exchange 200 or 300 elsewhere for 100 here.
Do you think it's harder for the bowlers to get on the honours board?
Well, I'm going to be a biased bowler and say, well, of course it is. As a batsman, there's no limit to how many runs you can score. Well, there is, but I mean, like Gooch can get 333, can't he? But the most wickets a bowler can get in a match is 10, and if there's in an inning, sorry, is 10, and if there's four bowlers competing for it, I mean,
yeah,
you've got to shine out from the pack. So there is, it is harder for a bowler. I always remember, I mean, Shane Warne again. In the 2005 Ashes, England lost at Lords, didn't they? It was McGrath got his, did he get his 500th Test wicket or something like that? Because he changed
his
boots,
yeah, got his
and
500.
Got gold boots. I mean, McGrath got a five here every time that he played, and I remember Warne being off. Australia had won the game, England were nine down. It was just a question of when Simon Jones was going to get out, and Warne was bowling from the nursery end. And there'd been a couple of heaves, near misses, chips into gaps, and he had four wickets, so he was clutching for his fifer. And then McGrath was bowling at the pavilion end, and Jones edged the ball to Warne at first slip as a catchable height. And you thought, I think it was the fourth or fifth ball of the over, and you thought, well, Warne could shell this. And so it wouldn't make any difference to the game, but it means that he'd probably get his fifer in the next over. But now he held on to it, and so with that went his last chance of getting a fifer at Lord's. So. Yeah, I mean, again, I suppose when you've achieved what you've achieved, it might not be as big a thing to some of them as others, but...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm sure every time that they, now since the retirement, they walk into that dressing room, they'd wish, well, it'd have been nice if one of the my outstanding performance would have been there.
Well, now, as promised at the top of the podcast, we meet a Middlesex member whose family have been associated with Lords since the late 19th century. His name is Peter Beaton. Peter's grandfather, William, worked at Lords from 1890, which is the same year that the current pavilion was built. William, who was known as Sam, was a pavilion steward here at Lords in the late 19th century and early 20th century, and amongst his duties, he'd have to draw W.G. Grace's baths. Peter's father also worked as Lords later. He was an attendant in the Real Tennis courts, and his mum was a cook in the staff canteen, so quite a family history here at this great old ground. As a young boy, Peter would often play at number 6 Grove End Road, where his granddad lived, and he recently brought in some artefacts to Lords for me to have a look at, one of which was a lovely photograph. In it, we can see his grandfather, Sam, standing with a tray of drinks during a tea break between Middlesex and Gloucestershire from 1933. I caught up with Peter in the MCC Museum to take a look at the photo.
12th man didn't take out drinks.
No, it's this lovely photo here.
Yes, yes. Well, he would take out drinks at drinks interval, and there'd always be a pint in the middle for the fast bowler. And then, energy drinks, no. It'd be a pint in the middle for the fast bowler. Orange juice is all around it.
So the fast bowler always have a pint of ale on that drinks tray?
Oh, yes.
Cigarettes as well?
No, not
in the middle?
No, not in the middle, no.
Even then?
I don't think it was unknown for somebody to have a quick drag on the boundary, but there'd be a pint in the middle for the fast bowler. And, of course, initially we had gentlemen and players exiting from different places.
Hence the bowler's bar.
Indeed.
Middlesex member Peter Beaton there, talking about his family's time here at Lords and how things have changed, which is listening to that greatly so, Gus.
They have. I mean, it's interesting when I started, they're also at Headingley. When you used to go out for lunch in the pavilion, there were a couple of tins of light ale on the table, in the middle of the table as you went in. And I always remember John Embry once, when we had a drinks break, asking the 12th man to bring him out a lager shandy in one of those sort of the plastic drinks bottles so that you couldn't see what was in it. But now to sort of think that you're going to get alcohol out in the field or during the day's play now is quite rightly something that you don't contemplate. But again, you sort of look back in the gentlemen and players, and that's part of the beauty of this ground, isn't it? I mean, I suppose it's the same everywhere, but a lot of other grounds, pavilions have been knocked down, and therefore with that, the different things. And whilst internally Lords has changed from where it was maybe 60, 70 years ago, but I say the two gates, the gentlemen that come out the main pavilion entrance, or pavilion entrance that the players come out now. The players used to come out from the entrance sort of between the pavilion and the Warner stand, and the bowler's bar, named because that was where the players changed, and players tended to be bowlers, batsmen tended to be gentlemen, hence it's called the bowler's bar. So, no, all those sort of little, I think there's a story behind so many things that are here, and they're lovely, and you just sort of just want them to be maintained, really. I mean, you don't want them suddenly to... Well, they're not going to knock the pavilion down, that's for sure, but the fact that sort of the history of the game is represented here, I think, is something that I'm sure the MCC will look to continue with.
Lovely, and I'll make sure that the people listening to this, that the photograph that we're looking at is up on the website with
Peter Beaton, aren't they?
Yeah, his grandfather. So the stewards used to take out the drinks at the drinks break, not the 12th man.
But there's a bloke there in a dark three-piece suit and a tie on. There's two with sort of really like proper drinks people, aren't they? Rather than the 12th man running along with almost like a bag full of soft drinks.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's I think, as he was saying, a pint of ale for the fast bowler. So that would have suited you back in the day.
No, never. Go straight to your head.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Well, moving on now, I'd like to talk about Bob Willis. The former England bowler was here at Lords last month. As one of just four bowlers to take more than 300 test victims for his country, it's no great surprise that Willis managed to get 3 5-wicket hauls here at the home of cricket. I caught up with Willis on the balcony of the pavilion and asked him what he remembers from the first of those against Australia in 1977.
Well, it's always great taking wickets against the old enemy. It was... it was the Jubilee Test Series. Australia's side were a little bit under the cosh because the Packer Series was about to be announced, so they weren't a particularly unified bunch, but they played some good cricket here at Lords. And surprisingly, I took a few wickets from the nursery end. I always much prefer bowling at the pavilion end at Lords, but to pick up 7 wickets against Australia at the home of cricket, very, very special indeed.
and the honours boards weren't physically there, but you must have known, you know, to take a 5-wicket haul at Lord's. Is it something you sort of dreamt about growing up?
Yes, people compare hundreds with 5-wicket hauls. I think it's much more difficult to take 5 wickets in a test match than it is to score 100. I think 4 wickets is probably equivalent to a test match 100. So if you can get a 5-wicket haul, it's definitely very special. And Michael Hunt here and dear old Jim Fairbrother before him make pretty flat batting pitches at Lord's. They want the matches to go well into the fifth day. So pretty hard work for bowlers. So to get a 5-wicket haul at Lord's, certainly your name should be engraved in stone, not just being on the honours board.
A forthright Willis there on getting his name up on the honours board. I guess in the bowlers union, you probably agree with him.
Yeah, I like Bob. I mean, again, I say I'm good friends with Bob and see quite a lot of him when at Sky and at other functions. And sort of people's perception of him because of the way that he sort of commentates or is wrong. There are other people who'd say the first things that come into their head and sort of don't really back it up. But if Bob says something, he's given it a lot of thought, and quite often he's right. And even though at times he might sort of seem a bit dour and miserable, his assessment of situations is very good, and he doesn't sort of mess around as such. So I've got, and he's good fun away from cricket as well. So I'm very fond of Bob and a wonderful bowler. And it's little things like from him. I mean, people know that every day of his career he went running, and I say it's something he sort of said when I started to break into the English side and met him. He used to go running every day if he was sort of religiously. I mean, yeah. if he bowled, then he wouldn't go for a run. But obviously, on any other day, he'd go for a run, and it's something that I adopted. So, if we had a batting day at Middlesex, I'd do 10 laps of the ground. At the end of a day's play, sort of 35-40 minute run, just to, because getting on your feet, getting your legs used to it and stuff like that. So although he sort of looked a bit out away with the fairies, and you always sort of remember him rushing off the field at Headingley, don't you, almost like in a trance, sort of having taken 8 for there, he was in many ways, I suppose, quite a lot ahead of his time, because much to the annoyance of his county, he didn't sort of run in and bust a gut for Warwickshire day in, day out. He paced himself and saved himself for England, and I suppose that might be why he got 320 test wickets and I ended up with 180. Because he worked out that the place to save it for was international cricket, and a fine bowler as well, a hostile bowler. He was a bowler that obviously a lot of people, my brother and I, we used to sort of imitate when we were young, sort of with the right hand sort of flapping to his side. And coming in at an angle, or coming in then like an almost like an S-shaped run-up, wasn't it?
Because you came in at an angle, didn't you?
Yeah, it wasn't sort of mimicking him.
That wasn't it.
I think that sort of just became towards the back end of your career, because your body gets older and stiffer. You find it harder to get round. So if you're at an angle, you're halfway there as it is. But no, Bob's a magnificent bowler, and I've enjoyed him as a broadcaster too.
And he's got a kind of understated sense of humour, hasn't he? Almost.
Yeah.
Cheeky in a way.
I think some people sort of don't understand when he's actually being sort of mischievous and fun as well. It's sort of, it's the presentation, isn't it? It's sort of, he's good company. He's good company, and had a few sort of social lunches with him over the years, and you don't struggle for conversation with him. It sort of just sort of flows, and he's obviously got opinions.
It's your county's 150th anniversary here at Lord's next year. Goes without saying, really. Got to be looking forward to that.
Yeah, big year for the club. 150 years. I mean, it's one of the older clubs, or county clubs, in the country. And it sort of links with the MCC's 200th year playing here at Lord's. So, a big year for the ground. A number of do's and functions and things that have been organised throughout the year. We've actually made our little, I mean, something I've done in my position, we're going back to the old cable knit sweaters. I mean, the modern sweaters now are sort of the ones, sort of almost like those sheen material ones with your name and your number on the back, and a bit like football shirts, aren't they, rather than cricket jumpers. So as a sort of, for the 150th year, we're going to go back to the old cable knit cricket sweaters, which I prefer.
Yeah. So you bring in those the kind of the cream ones.
Yeah.
They kind of
The sort of the old fashioned.
The old fashioned ones. So is that just for a year, or is that going to be?
We'll see.
Are you going to try and sneak it in for good?
I don't know. I prefer them. I prefer the look, and I can understand why people want the other things because it has got the. It's easier to identify players from the boundary. But yeah, it's just a small little thing. It'd be nice to get a bit more retro, but I don't think we sell enough merchandise to go completely retro. Maybe with our one day kits as well, but yeah, we'll leave it as it is. But no, it'd be nice, and again, it'd be nice for us to have a good year with that. And by that, I don't mean sort of all of a sudden you start setting targets about we're going to win this, we're going to do that. But as a club, our goal is to be up there competing every year, and in four-day cricket and in white ball cricket, and hopefully we can improve on last year and push that a little bit harder. And who knows what can happen if you're up there competing in the last month of the season.
And you're looking forward to Christmas then?
Yes, I don't know where the winter goes. You sort of sit down at the end of September, absolutely. Stuffed from a sort of emotionally and sort of exhausting period, and you think, nice to get a few weeks off, but all of a sudden it's December, it's Christmas, and once you get to Christmas, you come back from the Christmas break, bang, it's only 2 months, and one of the months is February. So it just seems to fly by the winters, but I haven't got a great deal planned. Hopefully I'll be doing a bit with Sky. I quite enjoy that. I mean, again, people sort of say, well, that's not time off, but I find it quite good to sort of be in there, talking to different cricketers, watching different cricket around the world. You just get a better appreciation of what's taking place. And although I don't know how many people sort of sit up at night watching India play New Zealand or whatever the test matches that sometimes are over Christmas, because I'm not in the A team at Sky, which sort of covers the Ashes as such. But I enjoy watching that and to do a bit of Sky. And trying to rest. I haven't had a holiday yet. I could do with a holiday. Do you know anywhere to go that's cheap?
not right now. But I mean, when you're at Sky, is it nice to kind of catch up with old pals of the game? I guess
a little bit. It's interesting because when I became a journalist, you almost sort of thought, well, that would you spend a lot of time with former teammates like Nasser or Mike Atherton. Or Ian Botham or David Gowan, people you play with. But you don't, because as a written journalist, it's a different lifestyle to a commentator. A commentator sort of, obviously, is there working during the hours of play, whereas a journalist, your work almost starts when the play finishes. And by the time you go out for your evening meal, they've already eaten or done what they've wanted to do. So you didn't actually catch up with them as much as possible. But yeah, I did, and now you sort of spend some time with Mark Butcher, Rob Key, Dominic Cork. Ramps, people like that. Obviously, I see Ramps because he's at Laws, but a number of other Robert Croft sort of blokes that you played a bit of cricket with and get on well with. And I say, you just sit there, like a couple of mates, sort of chatting throughout the night, being silly so and so's, watching some cricket. And then if there's a bit of rain or during the lunch and tea intervals, we sort of jump into action and obviously try and describe what's taking place. So it's not too arduous, but no, it is a good time to sort of catch up. And I suppose to think cricket in a sort of outside the Middlesex bubble, which you sort of tend to get into. And I think it's important you sort of try and see a bigger picture than just what's taking place in Middlesex's case, within the four walls of this ground here.
Absolutely. Do you ever get sort of stuck in a it was different in my day mindset, or just try and take yourself out of that, as it were? I mean you obviously trained as a journalist to do that quite well. Do you find maybe pundits naturally slip into that without almost knowing it?
It's a difficult one, because whilst you don't want to sort of, and it sounds like I would be like a Fred Truman type figure, though, I don't know what's going off out there, didn't happen in my day type of thing. And I realise that the game moves forward, and the changes that are made, they're not, most of them are for the good. The greater attention to detail, I think it can go slightly over the top. And again, I don't know whether at times the sort of, because TV coverage is so good now and you see so much, like the ball comes out of a bowler's hand and you can see the seam rotating. and you can see the stitching on the seam. So you see so much now, and the edges and little sort of batsman's techniques and things like that. And whether that sort of, I don't think that helps. It's people say, oh, we can, I don't know, because you then become too precise and it's difficult. You've sort of become too technically orientated rather than getting out there and getting the thick of a battle. If it's a game of cricket, it's me against you. I'm the bowler, you're the batsman, I'm trying to get you out. I want to spend as little time as I can out there, and you're keeping me out here, so I want to see the back of you. And it's getting in that battle that's important, and obviously you need to sort of trust your technique behind. So sometimes maybe, and you sound a bit old-fashioned, but sort of, because there's so much around and technology things that you use, you forget about the basics, really, which, again, is hitting a good, as a bowler, it's hitting a good length hard. Sort of just undoing that time and time again without getting too funky, and batsmen watch the ball hit the ball type of thing. I mean, I know it sounds simple, but you're sort of so worried about your pick up, your stance, your feet movements, your press, or whatever you want to call it, where your head's positioned. I mean, at times you've just got to get out there and get in the battle, and so you sound a bit old fashioned at that. So I think what I try and combine really, it's old dressed up as new, really. You want old fashioned principles, because the hard work, pride in the team that you represent, taking a long term view on things, and not just wanting to make a quick buck as such, but wanting to really be someone who in 30, 40 years time is looked back on as a top player. And doing well in games that count. I mean, I'm still a traditionalist in the way that test cricket, first class cricket, I think are the two most important forms of the game, and they will tell you how good a player is throughout his career, but that doesn't mean there's not a place for the other forms of the game. But when people sort of say, "Now, well, this in 2020 and the white ball game is gets a bit sort of, it all gets blown out of proportion," so you're trying to sort of stay true to the game, really, and do what's right for the game, in the way that you do things, in the way that you prepare the Middlesex team, and the things that you want it to achieve, really.
Well, I hope you have a good year next year with Middlesex and with MCC as well. So, thank you very much for coming on the Lords podcast.
Pleasure, no trouble at all.
Lovely. Well, many thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next month, which will be in January of 2014, with more cricketing stories from Lords. So remember to follow us on Twitter, we're at Home of Cricket, be our friend on Facebook, and for all the latest news from Lords, just go to lords.org. See you soon.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.